I would wager that most broadly left-leaning people, including many of you watching this channel, are quite concerned about the midterm elections. You're concerned in particular about what Donald Trump might do to subvert the outcome. You remember January 6th. You see the headlines about Trump trying to get control of mail-in ballots, of Trump trying to sue states to get voter rolls. You see him issuing broad executive orders that purport to wrangle control of elections from the states to the White House. And you're worried, right, that even if Democrats win, something will happen that will prevent them from taking power. Now, a while back, I did a video explaining why I did not think, based off of an analysis of how the process works, of the various weak points of the process. Now, a while back, I did a video asking essentially how are the ways that the president could subvert the actual midterm elections, looking at the various pressure points and weak points and the like. And my conclusion was basically that although you should not dismiss the potential for anything, you should always remain vigilant, that this is an extraordinarily difficult lift. That, say, posting ICE agents or CBP agents or whomever at polls might work in a single state, might work in a cluster of districts, but there's going to be dozens of competitive districts. There are many competitive Senate seats, and states are huge. In many of these elections, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of voters will be voting. And voters, for the most part, aren't actually concentrated in a handful of places. You would need a little army of guys to be able to successfully do this in one state. I think of my state of Virginia, much less across the country. And that's setting aside the fact that if we just look at how the administration has been organized, how the administration has acted over the past year, there's no real evidence on display that they're competent enough, put together enough, anything enough to really accomplish this. The same goes for the various lawsuits. The administration has lost all of them. The Department of Justice literally does not have enough guys, does not have enough people to put forth to try to win these cases. And this is setting aside the fact that there's just no legal basis for the administration's attempt to seize control of elections. Now, a lot of you, when I say stuff like that, says, well, who cares about the law? They don't care about the law. And that's not true. The law confers legitimacy, and they want to do these things, and they want these things to have a veneer of legitimacy. So they do care about the law. That's why they sue, right? That's why they actively try. That's why they engage in the legal process. And the fact that the law just isn't on their side, even Trump judges are rejecting this stuff, is a sign of how difficult it is to do this. Even the much publicized raid of the Fulton County offices was an attempt to find evidence for Trump to vindicate his 2020 conspiracies. And when he gave a speech about it, he whiffed. He did not actually bring forth any new evidence of conspiracies. That's because A, there wasn't any, and B, because no one would take it seriously. Legitimacy matters. Some veneer of a process that isn't tainted matters. I think people are still worried about what might happen in November, but I think those worries have subsided. I think the new worry is what might happen in January. Let's say Democrats do win the House and the Senate. What might Republicans do afterwards to subvert the outcome? Now here, I really do want to say that I think a lot of you overestimate both Republican ingenuity and the success of various Republican plots. I think a lot of folks have bought into the Republican Party's own propaganda about itself, about the genius of figures like Mitch McConnell and the like. I think if you take an objective look at Republican plots, what you see is that a lot of them just aren't very successful. They don't quite amount to much. You see plenty of failure. We just witnessed failure yesterday, a bunch of Republican pen ballot initiatives in Missouri and Kansas designed to destroy income taxes and restrict abortion failed. It's true that, say, when the Supreme Court decided it's going to gut the Voting Rights Act and attempt to nullify the 14th and 15th Amendments, Republicans take advantage of it aggressively. But taking advantage of the rules as they are is very different than disposing with the rules altogether. Honestly, I think people even overstate the Republican Party's win-loss record in elections. I think the shock of Donald Trump winning convinces people that somehow the Republican Party is an unstoppable juggernaut. But that's not really the case. They lose elections all the time. 2024 was an anti-incumbent year, and Republicans won, just like anti-incumbent parties across the world won. It happens that our Republican Party is insane, and that's what makes it so significant. But I would not chalk it up to some unique Republican genius. The fact of the matter is that the U.S. is in an unusual period where the electorate is basically evenly divided between the two parties, and there's a high level of polarization. There's just a lot of competition in the way that there wasn't 20 years ago or 40 years ago or 60 years ago. Anyway, the point is that when thinking about what the Republican Party might do in November, you have to remember that these are just guys. They do not have any special insight. They don't have a magic touch. They are unusually aggressive in trying to make use of the available rules in order to pursue their agenda, a thing I think Democrats should be better about. But even that doesn't guarantee success. They're not completely unified, and they're responsive to public sentiment. That's why they care about the legitimacy. And so what could they do in January if Democrats win the midterms? Well, most concerns here center on seating the House. Two things to understand. The first is that the Senate is what's called a continuing body. It never gavels out. It's always existing. Because it's a continuing body, it does not reconstitute itself at the beginning of each session. Instead, whichever party happens to momentarily hold the between-session majority is the one that gavels in and begins proceedings to constitute a new majority for the full session. As it so happens, in 2027, that will be the Democrats. Whether or not they win a majority overall, in those opening days, there'll be, I think, 36 Democrats in the chamber compared to 34 Republicans. They'll be the ones gaveling in. They'll be the ones who have control of the process. And so shenanigans in the Senate side are actually much more difficult. The House is a little different. This is the second point to remember. The House begins anew with every session. So on January 3rd of 2027, regardless of who wins the House majority, there will be effectively no House members. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, will not have any authority. He won't be Speaker. He'll just be a guy. How the process works is the clerk of the House begins to swear in members. During this swearing-in process, if there are objections to the credentials of any member, those members step aside for those objections to be adjudicated after all members have been sworn in. A few things to remember here, then. If you hear someone say, oh, Mike Johnson isn't going to allow the House to be seated, that's not a thing he can do. Now, of course, this doesn't account for sending armed men to barricade the House to prevent people from coming in. But at that point, I think we'll have bigger problems to deal with, right? So for now, we're looking at scenarios that don't hinge on the total dissolution of the rule of law. That could happen. I think it's a very small chance of that happening. But it could happen, but we're not talking about those right now. We're talking about things that could plausibly happen and maintain the veneer of legitimacy. So the thing about the clerk of the House is that the Speaker can replace the clerk. Mike Johnson could, in September, October, replace the clerk of the House. Replace that clerk of the House with someone who would try not to swear in Democratic members. You might think that this is a trump card, but it isn't, because there is no rule or law that says that objections have to be honored during the swearing-in process. If someone objects to a Democratic member, the Democratic member doesn't have to stand aside. The objection can be registered and they can receive the oath anyway. And then the majority afterwards would deal with those objections. And the majority in this case, if Democrats win, would be the Democrats. The thing about this process of objections and disqualifying members is that it really is only feasible, A, if you have the majority, or if it's a nonpartisan situation, like a member did something horrible and they won, and then everyone decides this person can't be in. But if a party is in the minority, then unilaterally trying to disqualify members is extraordinarily difficult. I'm not going to say impossible, non-zero possibility of everything, but extraordinarily difficult. And it's worth saying that all of this probably hinges on the actual outcome of the elections. If Democrats do win a kind of wave victory and there are 230, 240 members, there is just no point in engaging this charade. In that scenario, I actually think Republicans will be like, you know what, we lost and we're not going to make things worse for us by going through all of this nonsense. Most Republicans, I think some might try it. And I kind of think the modal outcome here, the thing you'll see most often if you were to model this, is that, yes, some Republicans make objections to House members, especially if there are a few close elections. Those objections are noted. Democrats dismiss them when they have the majority and things move on. That's not nothing. It's a bad thing that Republicans will have adopted this approach of trying to delegitimize people who won, but it's not going to change the fact that Democrats have the majority. The other thing to note here is that neither the House nor the Senate nor anyone like Mike Johnson certifies elections. That is done by the states themselves. And many of these contested seats are in Democratic-led states with Democratic elected officials. Trying to take advantage of the certification process is a whole other level of complexity, which, again, I'm not going to totally rule it out. But you have to recognize that to do all of these things together requires a kind of intricate scheme with a lot of moving pieces and a lot of high-level competence. And I need everyone to ask themselves, have they seen the capacity to do that from this administration? Have they seen it? I'll end this by saying what I said in the last video I did about this stuff, which is not to say that you should not worry about anything. No. It is to say that you should not let fear become the mind killer. You should not let fear lead to the little deaths that presage the larger death.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I'm permitted to pass over me and through me.
You should let that fear instead motivate you to get involved, because the surest way to protect elections in the fall and afterwards is by being active and mobilized. It's by working the polls. It's by being a poll watcher. It's by bringing friends to vote. And it's by being ready to object with your physical presence should anything really pop off in January. Whatever plans Republicans have, whatever plans the president has, depends on a public that is apathetic, listless, and resigned to failure. They depend on your cynicism. They depend on a sense that there's nothing you could do to change the outcome. It's not all in your head, but a lot of it is. That's why they're constantly pumping out propaganda. That's why they're constantly talking about how they dominate all their opponents. They want you to think that you can't win.
You can't win.
But the fact of the matter is that you can't. The even larger fact is that they're scared.
It's afraid. It's afraid!
And that it's you who has the winds at your sails. As always, let me know what you think, and I'll see you next time.